Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I suppose I should welcome myself back to After the Buzzer because I've been out for a little bit under the weather, way under the weather. Mike Gross, Gordy Jones. Gordy, how are you?
Outstanding. How are you, sir? Better, I hope?
Getting better, yeah. I'm getting better, and hopefully I will be cough-free for this edition of the big show. Our guest today is Jack McCallum, who you may recognize from many years at Sports Illustrated. You may recognize from the book The Dream Team, the best-selling book The Dream Team about the Olympic, the 92 Olympic basketball team. We are here to talk today about his 12th book, The Real Hoosiers, Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson, and The Hidden History of Hoops. Jack, welcome, and let's start with this. The Dream Team book, that was sort of a no-brainer for you because you had covered the sport for so long. You had such a relationship with all of those guys. This is much less so of a no-brainer. So tell us how you found your way into this story and what made you want to tell it.
Well, I thank you, by the way, for the introduction. Thanks for having me. I know whoever will bother to do my obituary, as Gordy knows, probably only the morning call.
Does that still exist?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Probably the second sentence will be, you know, a connection to the Dream Team and that era of covering basketball for Sports Illustrated. But it's funny, I never sort of, I certainly don't reject that because nobody would know my name if it wasn't for those guys. But it's not like that's all I wanted to do. I remember after I wrote the Dream Team book, my agent called me and said, well, let's do the big Jordan bio or the Magic bio. And I said, no, I'm going to do a book about my prostate cancer, which sold, you know, probably 2,000 copies, but I had fun doing it. So I kind of went into this with a little more. Sometimes the best things you can do are things when you don't know as much about the subject. You have to kind of find, you're going into it with fresh eyes and fresh ears and a fresh brain. I know I'm a little bit old to have all those fresh things, but it was during the pandemic when I thought of the idea. I was doing some research on basketball history and race and things like that. It was kind of a time for reflection, that COVID time, and I was rehabbing from a knee replacement. And so I was just looking for something different to do, and I came upon this story, which is not totally unknown, but it certainly does not leap out in boldface to everyone.
The Real Hoosiers, of course, refers to the movie, which a lot of people remember very fondly, and which I certainly enjoyed. A lot of people did, but there's a story there that a lot of people don't know exists, and just very in very obvious form, this basketball team that came along the 2 years after that team that was portrayed in the movie. Just tell us a little bit about this basketball team.
Well, the connection to the movie Hoosiers was kind of impossible to ignore.
Right.
I mean, the Hoosiers has kind of, you know, and I would be a hypocrite if I, you know, began it with the thesis, well, I hated Hoosiers and buried the real history.
Right.
And
that's
it's
right.
That would be a hypocrite. Angelo Pizzo, who wrote the movie, I'm not going to say close friend, but a friend of mine. When I was teaching at Muhlenberg College, I invited Angelo to speak to the class. So that movie is in my brain pan, and I didn't start to do this as a, you know, kind of quote answer to the movie.
Right.
However, you have to deal with it, and what I said to the publisher was probably the chapter that most people will read will be the one about the connection to the movie, and it is the one I had the most fun doing. So just to be very brief, Hoosiers the movie is not taken from a book or an original source material, Angelo Pizzo and David Anspaugh, the two guys that made it, the director and the writer, knew this story of Milan High School,
right,
which won the Indiana State Championship in 1952, not 19, as it's presented in the movie. So it, to a certain extent, it has that source material.
Yeah.
So in the movie, they get to the state final, this plucky little team from Milan High School, little town, they were called Hickory in the movie, and they beat kind of what turned out to be, or what most people saw as, the big black team from the city. So over the years, as Oscar became more famous, and this legend kind of grew, and the movie had its own mythologization for a lot of good reasons. Number one, it was just a great movie. Yeah. You know, it had Gene Hackman, and you know, it was just a terrific movie. It sort of became, oh, well, Hickory High was the real team, and the team they really beat was Oscar's inner city team from Indianapolis. But that's not what the director and the writer intended from the beginning. However, they do know that they were influenced by the real Milan High story. And the two coaches of the Hickory High School, the coach of Hickory High School is Ray Crow, who was Oscar's high school coach. And the assistant coach they show is Oscar's brother, Flap Robertson, who played at Crispus Attucks High School. So, to a certain extent, what happened, though, was an example of reality, and that is the white narrative, which is a fictional narrative, Hickory High School, took over the black narrative, which is the real thing that happened. So, there's a lot that can come out of that, and, you know, a lot of material to draw from that, and it's impossible not to mention reality without mentioning the movie.
In fact, in 55 and 56, Oscar's junior and senior year, they went 61-1 and won two state titles. Your point is well taken. I thought I heard you on Jeff Perlman's podcast where you said that uniformly the guys that you talked to from that team hate Hoosiers, correct?
Yeah, I mean, sure. As an example of what happens, so the movie comes out, and a couple of years after the movie comes out, the Indiana Pacers in Indiana, you know, housed in Indiana, make a replica Hickory High jersey.
Yeah, I remember that.
Before they ever honor the real team from Indianapolis, which not only was the first black high school to win a state championship, but was actually the first team from Indianapolis to win a state title. And the tournament had gone on by the time Attucks won it. The tournament had been gone on for, you know, 45 years or so. So it wasn't the big city teams that always won the state title in Indianapolis. It was more these type of little teams like Milan High School presented as Hickory High in the movie. They were a small school. It's not, they did overcome pretty good odds. Mm-hmm. However, they were not the first really small all-white team to win a state championship in the state of Indiana. That was sort of the template to win the state championship. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in fact, the Pacers themselves actually wore those Hickory uniforms in games. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the deep thinkers in Philadelphia putting up a Rocky statue before a Joe Frazier statue. It's like the same.
Yeah,
well, it's exactly the same.
Yeah,
it's sort of like you can understand it if you're a marketing person.
Right.
A marketing person trying to figure out what's, hey, we're still talking about Hoosiers, which came out in 86 or 87.
Right.
And, you know, I heard actually from Angelo today, you know, he sent me an email, and my chapter about Hoosiers in the book, you know, he was not entirely pleased with.
Really?
And yeah, and I wrote him back. I said, Angelo, you know, you wrote a movie that people will still be watching in 50 years. Please be happy. Please be happy that you did this. And he did it, you know, he also did Rudy a couple years later, the same team, David Anspaugh and Angelo Pizzo, the screenwriters. Right. So they came out with Hoosiers and Rudy, which is a career, you know, for most people. Mm-hmm. So we understand the power of fiction, mm-hmm. and we understand the power of cinema. Mm-hmm. That was Rocky, that was Hoosiers. Mm-hmm. But it's still, nevertheless, you cannot ignore the cold hard fact that it is the white fictional narrative overtaking the black realistic narrative.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's something that I really didn't know, although I guess it's not surprising, but from reading the book, Jack, which is that Oscar Robertson and most of his teammates, or many of his teammates, migrated from the South to Indianapolis. And migrated for what they thought, what was a better life, is that fair to say? But was still a racially tinged environment. So tell us a little bit about people who may have no idea, like me, about that piece of it.
Well, the story of Oscar Robertson and Attucks High School is in fact the story of the Great Migration, and
right.
a person, you know, 100 times smarter than me, Isabella Wilkerson, you know, won a National Book Award by chronically it, Bill Russell's parents. Bill Russell came from Russell, Louisiana, Monroe, Louisiana. His parents happened to migrate due to the fact that there was racial segregation, Jim Crow laws, and they thought the economics of life better for them would be better if they moved north. They happened to end up in Oakland, California.
Yeah.
Oscar's people happened to end up in Indianapolis, Indiana. This was replicated millions of times. And so what was happening as this was going on was there were more and more African Americans coming north. Specifically, we're talking now about Indianapolis. There were jobs there. There were manufacturing jobs. There were, you know, some crappy jobs, but there was opportunity, economic opportunity. So in the same thing we see replicated in our society today, this fear of migrants overtaking, you know, our culture, replacement theory, that's what was going on in Indianapolis. And the entire reason that Christmas Attucks High School was built was this fear that too many blacks, too many African Americans were crowding into the pretty much white Indianapolis public school system. So they mandated the construction of this high school on the west side of Indianapolis, which was the crappy side of Indianapolis, and they gave it kind of, they built a nice building, actually. It was a pretty nice building, but, you know, it had didn't have a gym that was enough to have basketball games in, second-hand chairs, third-hand equipment, but the joke kind of what was on them, because Attucks turned into this high, for a variety of reasons, turned into this high-caliber high school, which nobody really saw that coming.
And one of the ironies of this, which you've talked about, is that they ended up playing their games in Butler University's gym, which if you remember the movie Hoosiers, was seen as this awesome facility, with the famous scene with Gene Hackman with the measure from the all that stuff. So was that seen like as an advantage that they had to play in that facility?
Well, what happened was, as you said, they had this small gymnasium when it was first built. It was built the first year of Attucks High School was 1927. You couldn't play any home games. If you look at Attucks' early schedule, it is unbelievable where they played high school sports, mostly basketball, but also football. They went to Kentucky. They went to Oklahoma. You know, and these were all on, you know, rickety school buses because they could only play black high schools, and they had all away games. Then they started playing a little bit in the auditorium, where you could literally fall off the stage, you know, going out of bounds.
We have one of those around here, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, sort of, hey, we were in gyms like that around here.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a little bit of that Rock Me Hall times 10 type of thing. So, what happened then was that when the teams of the 50s became really good, the Attucks High teams, they had to still play all their games away. And eventually they started putting him at Butler Fieldhouse, which was a, I think it had opened way back in 1928, and it was like a, it was a basketball palace, and it's still a pretty cool gym, by the way. If you have a chance, it's not, you know, sort of bucket listish to go watch a game at Butler. But anyway, so they started playing there, and, you know, they became so good that they became a show. So then it sort of, Butler became their home gymnasium. So by the time Oscar was a senior, they had already won the state title as a junior. Now it kind of turned from this story of this team having to find another gym to, oh, they have this incredible advantage because they're playing at Butler, and that's like their home gym. So by the time they got to the regionals, And state tournament, Butler Gym was in fact their home gym. But the scene where in the movie where they walk in to this cavernous Butler Fieldhouse, these kids from Hickory High School, and look all around, and somebody yells, and there's an echo, and like you said, Gene Hackman measures the basket just to show this is a basketball court.
Right.
That is a great movie scene. I mean, I would leave that in any movie.
Yeah,
however, at that point, because Attucks was so good, pretty much every high school in Indianapolis or around had played in Butler Gymnasium.
Right.
You know, it wasn't that strange of a place. They played all the postseason games there, plus the Attucks games were played there.
It's interesting to me that this is far from just a basketball book, that a lot of it was, you know, you digging into the archives, like the Indianapolis Recorder, which was the African American newspaper back then, and while Indiana was a northern state in the Civil War, it was really a KKK stronghold for a long, long while. I wonder if you could talk about that, and, you know, what you found in your research about that.
Well, Indiana historians, you know, there's I had put in the book that Indianans began to roll their eyes, and soon as someone begins the sentence, Indiana is either the, it is either the northernmost southern state, or it is the southernmost northern state. And, you know, the reason that is because it was settled pretty much by settlers coming north from the south. It was settled kind of from the bottom up, you know, rather than the other way.
Okay.
So it was very much a Union state in the army. There was not slavery there, but it sort of had this, and I'm not saying it, you know, Indiana was exactly unique, but it sort of treaded this line between being a very, very, very Jim Crow state to being lawfully, you know, a northern state without those kind of laws. So that was always the subtext of the political and socioeconomic culture of Indiana. And one of the things that drew me into the story in the beginning, and I was trying to, you know, even thinking about writing a book on it, but then figured it was wrong, was the story of Marion, Indiana, which won the Indiana State Championship in 1926, celebrated in the Times Square, as you would do for small towns, and then 4 years later, there was a lynching in that same town square, which is represented as the northernmost lynching, and it kind of fascinated me how this Times Square, this town square, was the site of both of these things, you know, this archetypal small town celebration, and also the archetypal southern demonstration of racial hostility, which was a lynching. But in the end, I just decided that a chapter on that was better than this was not my. I need someone smarter than me or more historical than me than a a white guy, white-splaining the racial history of lynching to everyone. So I this was a book that was able to incorporate that, but also the basketball stuff.
And you, after Addicts won it, I wonder if you could just talk to our listeners about what happened with the parade around the square in Indianapolis. That was a real sticking point. There was real concern about the white folks in Indianapolis about what might happen downtown, right?
Yeah, well, the Christmas Addicts High School was built, as I said, on the west side of town, which mm-hmm. was the black side of town where everybody lived. Mm-hmm. And there was this place there called Indiana Avenue,
right,
which is where all the, you know, the clubs were and the movie theaters. And pretty much, the black people, the black citizens of Indianapolis pretty much confined where they went. Mm-hmm. To down there, and right. I'm talking not just the 1920s, even Oscar's team, you know, they pretty much knew where they could go mm-hmm. and where they wouldn't. So when Addicts started winning in the early 50s, this was before Oscar got there, his brother was on the team, mm-hmm. they started having a little success then. And it's funny, going back and looking at the Indianapolis Recorder that you mentioned, mm-hmm. and also the regular newspapers, mm-hmm. that all usually a big Addicts victory would be chronicled more as a story of all the hooping and hollering mm-hmm. and wild mm-hmm. nighting that would be going on down at the Avenue. Mm-hmm. You know, that, and so when they became mainstream enough to actually win a state championship and therefore warrant the kind of homage by all of Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. It was quite literally the first time in that city that the white populace would be called upon to kind of celebrate
sure.
with the black mm-hmm. populace. And what you referred to was pretty much the white leaders of the town were afraid.
Mm-hmm.
That all kinds of crap was going to break out. Yeah, that there's going yeah. to be, that Indiana Avenue would be transferred to all of Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And so the celebration after the first state title became kind of a fraught topic, particularly because Oscar later spoke up about the way he saw they were treated. Now, in all honesty, I found a little bit of problems with what he said, and it's hard to straighten out fact from fiction, and I think to a certain extent, the black population surrounding Crispus Attucks High School was probably more comfortable going back and celebrating with a giant bonfire back at Northwest Park, which is where they celebrated most things. So. Mm. It's kind of complicated to explain here. There is a chapter in the book about the post-victory celebration that's a little bit, kind of speaks to the whole issue of whites not being quite as familiar with the black culture and, you know, this intersection of cultures, which I know it seems kind of strange now, but I'm old enough to have, you know, been brought up when that was a very real thing, mm-hmm. you know, that there was not this kind of social blending, you know, yeah. that there was still a lot of their world and our world type of thing. And Crispus Attucks, their success in basketball, kind of brought this to a head in the city of Indianapolis and the state of Indiana.
Jack, a couple weeks ago, I wrote a story about some good local post players around here, small college post players, and they didn't know who Kevin McHale was. So that's the preface to the question for our audience that maybe is not as old as the three of us are. How good was Oscar Robertson? What do people need to know about him as a basketball player?
Well, I'll tell you what you can do. YouTube is a great thing. I mean, most of the time I'm going on there to go, oh, wait, I can look at that, you know, REM concert from the early 80s. But you can do better than that. You can Google Crispus Attucks High School, Oscar Robertson. And what comes up is there is a lot of material. Indiana State High School basketball, there's a lot of stuff you can look at. And it's not because I was looking at it just to do this book, but you look at the early 50s, even the Addicts teams, you know, the way all the old African-American Addicts teams, which had great athletes and great precision basketball, then you see Oscar. Oscar kind of comes along, and it just looks different. He just plays the game very differently. I mean, you guys probably are old enough to have seen him. I mean, I saw him even, you know, play a lot. But there's a great quote in Ray Crow, the coach had died, one of the many people that I couldn't talk to. But Ray had this great quote about trying to sum up Oscar. And his quote was, he just ran the game. That was Oscar. And I said, if you somehow could put 20 guys out there right now, including Magic and Michael and Bird and LeBron and all these guys, and Oscar was out there, trust me, Oscar Robertson would take the basketball and go, all right, you're going here. Now, he would get into an argument with Magic.
And
Michael would certainly say, well, you can pretend you have the ball, but it's really my ball. But I'm telling you, that's the kind of player Oscar was. He really moved it along. He went both directions. He had this jump shot. I described it as a waiter coming out, you know, serving a tray on one hand. You know, he kind of laid it on one hand.
Yeah, that's right.
He arm barred the defender away from him years before guys were doing that. Whatever spot he wanted to get to, you know, the great ineffable thing they say about point guard. Well, he got to where he wanted to go. Yeah. That was what Oscar did. If he wanted to go there, that's where he went. So he was this combination of finesse and strength. And not just because I was looking at it through the eyes I wanted to, but there is a difference when he came along, 1953, 1954, 55. It just looked different because Oscar was this great combination of both finesse, fundamentals, pure will, and power.
He did not talk to you for this book. Why do you think he didn't? And talk about that a little bit. Your attempts to get him to.
Yeah, well, there were 10 of them at least. And finally, you know, Oscar has through the years, if you go back and look, and I think one of the things you have to do with Oscar is compare him to Jerry West. I mean, they came in together.
Right.
They were the Bird. They were Bird and Magic. You can't get any better parallel. They co-captained the Olympic team in 1960. Then went to the NBA draft. Oscar went number one to the Cincinnati Royals. Jerry West went number two to the Minneapolis Lakers, who then moved to. That's who they were. And here it is, 60 some odd years later. Jerry West, pretty much every one of those years, has been associated with the NBA.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And Oscar has disappeared. I mean, the reason we know him, the average fan knows him, us three would know him, but the reason the average fan knows him, the only reason, is Russell Westbrook. The triple-double comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar sort of became alienated from the league, you know, pretty much as soon as he left it, back in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And this is both his own choice and the league choosing kind of not to sort of invite Oscar in warmly. Oscar's the kind of guy that he has a lot to be pissed off about, and he is. And all I can say is that I wish that he has been able to forget slights, to trust people a little bit more, to be a little less guarded, because I think that would have served his teammates at Crispus Attucks a little bit better. They understand that they were relatively anonymous because Oscar never really got into the spirit of doing things that would have gotten them more noticeable. Mm. And the only person that emerged from that pool of anonymity back in the mid-50s is Oscar Robertson. Now, he did it because he deserved it. He was a great, great player. But none of those other guys kind of got to ride along on those coattails, and that is certainly partly Oscar's fault, even though you can partly understand it. That's probably the best way I could put it.
Do you think the league ostracized him somewhat because of he was kind of a champion of labor? Do you think that factors into it as well?
Well, you bring up, and that is a good point, that Oscar, the lawsuit that pretty much opened up free agency in the NBA is called Oscar Robertson versus the NBA. Mm-hmm. From what I know about it, from dealing with David Stern a lot in later years, the NBA says, no, that is not the case. That Oscar was invited in at many times. They wanted more from Oscar. And, you know, Bill Russell had this for a long, long time, the treatment that he faced in Boston, the racial animus that he faced throughout his career. It took Bill Russell a long, long, long time to get back in the fold of the NBA, and a lot of entreaties from David Stern. Mm-hmm. This is just my opinion. I can't tell you for sure, but I think the NBA made those kind of entreaties to Oscar. And they did, by the way, this year's All-Star game. There was a lot about Oscar in Indiana.
And thank goodness for that.
And I think that Oscar, as much as them, resisted it. And on one hand, you can say, hey, you know, got to give the guy credit. He never pretended everything was great. He never went, oh, I'm going to forget all that and put our hands together and sing Kumbaya. He wasn't going to do that.
Yeah.
So I wish he would have, but I can partly, you know, I can partly understand why he didn't. I wish he would have, you know, the dirty little secret of this, and being a journalist, you guys kind of know this, in a way, him not talking to me was a positive, because I didn't want to write, I wasn't writing an Oscar biography.
No. Right.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
That wasn't what I kind of wanted to do. And if Oscar had talked to me for hours and hours and hours, then you're sort of kind of compelled to, you know, to turn that into it a little bit, because he is, beyond obvious to say, he's the central figure of this era. That's why I'm doing the book. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want it to be all filtered through Oscar.
No,
maybe that's rationalization, but that's how I'm looking at it.
No, I thought it was. I thought there was just enough of him there. I thought you told the overarching tale, you know, about Indiana's history, the good parts, the bad parts, and basketball was part of that, but just part of it, and Oscar was just part of that. So I thought it read really well that way. I think you accomplished the mission that you set out to accomplish.
Well, I'll quote you on that. I haven't heard from Oscar. I'm going out to, actually, the only event I'm doing is I'm going out to Indiana in a couple of weeks. I'm doing something at the Indiana Historical Society, which is sort of my own choice. I mean, I'm getting Ted Green, who made a great documentary about addicts, and I got James Madison. Could there be a better name for a historian than James Madison?
Yeah, I think not.
Professor at Indiana University, and they're going to be with me, and we're going to kind of talk about the three ways of looking at this material. So I'm really looking forward to that, and whether, you know, Oscar will ever make, I don't think Oscar will ever, make a comment about it, and that is certainly his choice.
Yeah.
Jack, let's shift gears a little bit. I am one of the many sports writers who started to want to be a sports writer because of Sports Illustrated. And obviously you have a more direct experience with it than I do. What are your thoughts? How do you feel about, I know how I feel, about the demise of what was a great institution in America, I think, Sports Illustrated.
Well, Yeah, well, obviously when all this, I mean, there's been this relentless barrage over the last 4 months of, you know, first it was the AI, artificial influence, which I think was overblown. Not that SI didn't screw it up, they definitely screwed it up, but their stories are not robot generated. This was some obscure ad package that you can click on, but in a way, it serves as the microcosm of what's going on there, which is they got these owners who came in to sort of, what they saw about SI was the brand. Oh, Sports Illustrated, the swimsuits, the bigness, the overarching thing about American culture in sports. So we can take that part of the magazine and that part of the Sports Illustrated name and monetize it. You know, we can have Sports Illustrated rec centers. We can have Sports Illustrated resorts. They had a party at the Super Bowl. I mean, I wasn't there. They had a Sports Illustrated party at the Super this year's.
Okay.
At the same time,
wow,
the magazine has kind of died.
Yeah.
So they took this idea of Sports Illustrated, and I don't think they understood that what created it was the magazine.
Yeah.
And so when all this came out, you know what's interesting to me is all the reactions to it, and the reactions have all been, yeah, people are sad, but it's all, you know, I used to come on Thursday and ride home on my bicycle and get it.
Yeah.
Or, hey, I was a Bobby Orr fan, and I remember that cover when he's flying through the air.
Yeah.
Or, I was a Michael Jordan fan, and I remember the first time. That's what it is. That was the power of Sports Illustrated. And obviously that had started to wane in an age when, you know, it's been written in the demise of daily newspapers. It's been written in the, you know, National Geographic. It's been written a lot of different places. But I do think Sports Illustrated is never going to be the same. It's not going to be the power that it has in American culture.
Right.
I do think, however, that there is a new owner out there somewhere who will realize the enduring power of this, that the disconnect between what people think of the magazine, which is still very, very, very high, and its power in the marketplace, which, as you guys know, is very, very low, somehow somebody's going to have to thread that needle and understand it is not going to be what it once was. There is no damn way in history.
Yeah.
It ain't coming back.
Yeah.
However, I still think that its power is enough that it can exist. And maybe I'm sort of a Pollyanna to believe that, but that's what I think.
So what's next, Jack? Got another one coming?
Yeah, you know, I just, every time I do this, I said, I don't know. You worry about, you know, you want to write a good book, and then, you know, you really want people to read it, you know, and so you do, it comes out, and you think it's a good book, and you knew you did your best on it, but then you go back and go, oh, shit, I put this up in chapter 4, and then, you know, not enough people are reading it, so, I don't know, I'm old enough that I don't know whether there's a, another one into it, but it's interesting, you know, guys, and if this is the final point, I mean, we've all been through this, you know, what we look at is the collapse of print and the dying of newspapers and the cratering of Sports Illustrated. When you do these things, you still realize how many people still like good stories.
Yeah.
That this community of people, whether I get on Twitter or email or Goodreads or wherever I go, that there's still these fanatical readers out there. And it really kind of warms your heart a little bit to know that, you know, that still exists out there. And that's kind of what keeps you going.
Yeah, that's what keeps you going.
I like that a lot. I had a couple stray points. The first one was you mentioned Jerry West and Oscar. I always, you know, growing up, I always kind of thought that Oscar was a little bit better than Jerry. But then I read, I forget where I read this, somebody wrote a book about West, and they argued that he was a better defender, he was a better rebounder, and he was a little better shooter, et cetera, et cetera. Where do you come down on the Oscar-Jerry argument?
Well, I'll tell you where Jerry comes down. Because I know very well, because Jerry, something, you know, it's funny you do this. I've been doing this journalism thing for 55 years, and certain quotes, certain little moments, and they're not necessarily big.
Right.
One of them was, by the way, from something you mentioned, Kevin McHale, earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what that was, but the one from Jerry was when we were talking about Oscar and this whole thing of coming into the league together. Jerry said that Oscar came into the league completely ready from the first moment he walked into the first pro locker room.
Mm-hmm.
He was so ready to play professional basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And Wes, who, believe me, thinks, you know, understands his own talents, said, but there's no way. Oscar was so much better than me the first minute that we came into the league. And this lasted, he said, for 4 or 5 years. Then Jerry thinks that he got better.
That's an interesting. Well, he's always been a good talent evaluator. We know that.
the difference between them is, here's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think because Oscar was so identified with having the ball and being the progenitive, point forward, being big enough to be a forward and being a point guard and always owning the ball and running the team.
Yes.
I think what we underestimate with Oscar was that dude was a scorer.
Yeah.
That guy was a scoring machine along the lines of looking for shots and looking for your own points, along the lines of Michael and Kobe, who I always think of the old, and maybe Iverson a little bit. Guys that, hey, we're looking for a way to score the damn ball.
Yeah, you know,
LeBron's not like that, and Magic's not like that, and even Larry wasn't like that. But so we overlooked that a little bit with Oscar.
I remember.
However, Jerry, which you mentioned, was 10 times a better defender than Oscar. When I was researching the book I kind of did on West and Steph Curry and California basketball, 4 or 5 years ago, what comes up with West was there may never, beside maybe Jerry Sloan, and maybe now LeBron, if he's guarding backcourt people, or Jordan, there's never a better defensive guard than that guy.
Yeah, he had those long arms.
Was unbelievable. Yeah. Somebody told me if they got on a 2-on-1 fast break and West was a defender, they pulled it back out.
Interesting. That's interesting.
Because he was going to screw the fast break up. He was going to block your shot, or he was going to steal you, or he was going to contest it. And so Oscar couldn't come close to him, in that department. They were both clutch players. They both suffered a lot for how they did not win. How long it took Jerry to win. And we know that Oscar didn't win until he got with Kareem in the Bucks.
Yeah. Your point about Oscar being a scorer and also the quote from Ray Crowe about how he ran the game reminds me of a long ago Dick Barnett quote where he said, if he gave Oscar a 10-footer, he wanted an 8-footer. If he gave him an 8-footer, he wanted a 6-footer.
Quote, believe it or not.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You mentioned it earlier. He always got where he needed to get to.
Dick Barnett, by the way, Oscar's opponent in the state championship final in 1955.
That's right. You did mention on the book. I forgot about that. That's right.
Barnett. So when the black team finally broke through and got to the finals, Crispus Attucks, they ended up playing another black team, Roosevelt High School from Gary, Indiana, which had not only Dick Barnett, but had Mr. Basketball that year. It had to be a senior. He was a big guy named Eisen. And they, can you imagine a team that had Mr. Basketball and Dick Barnett, you know, and they got crushed.
They got crushed by this
Christmas Addicts team. So that was sort of a measure. Years later, Dick Barnett would say, he said somebody from Addicts went and played college ball with him, and they said, damn, Dick Barnett told him, I never thought you were going to kick our ass that big. Like a 30-point game.
All right, Jack, we appreciate you. Sell a million books, man.
Yeah, it was really good to talk with you, Jack.
Yeah, hey, I appreciate the time, guys.
Always a pleasure.
All right, be well. Take care. Good luck with the book.
All right, see you later.
All right, take him, bye. Jack McCallum, ladies and gentlemen.
I love him.
There's a guy, he loves what he does, loves the sport, and I wouldn't say he's the flashiest writer, but you know he put in the work, and you know that he writes from a position of authority.
I thought this one was really well organized, tightly organized in a way that made it readable.
Yep.
When you're weaving sort of more multiple narratives.
Yep.
It's not really a basketball story.
No, it is not.
And I haven't finished it, to be honest with you. I've read a lot of it, but I haven't read the whole thing. But yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I love the book because it just goes, it has this overarching storyline, like, well, here's what it was like in Indiana back then, and a lot of it wasn't pretty.
Yeah.
You know, like he mentioned Marion and how, like, you know, there were three people lynched on the same town square in 1930 that 4 years earlier had hosted a parade.
How about that?
That's the most gripping chapter in the book.
Yeah, that's so dramatic.
Yeah.
And he wanted to, as he said here, but just to reiterate it, he wanted to write a book about that and then felt he wasn't the right guy to write it, so there's mention of it. But anyway, the other thing is, here we go. I hope we don't go. But anyway, one time when we were out traveling with Penn State, Frank led us on an excursion. Frank Bonanni, yes. Our pal, and we went through that part of Indiana, Indianapolis, which was at the time the black section. We went duck pin bowling.
Of course you did.
That says more about Frank than anything else. Me and Neil Gahagan and Frank are duck pin bowling in this area of Indiana that you could tell had been something different,
right?
Years ago. And it was sort of dead then, but not, I mean, there was stuff there, and it was sort of interesting. You could sort of tell that you were at a specific, really specific section of town, probably a poor or African-American section of town.
That's really good perspective. Yeah. I need to get back to Indianapolis because I've never been to Hinkle Fieldhouse, and I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I haven't been there either. I've been to Indianapolis many times.
Yeah, I've been there a couple times myself.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool city.
Yeah,
actually.
I agree.
It's sort of a manageable.
Yes.
Sort of some small town feel to it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But it's a city. It's a real city.
But yeah, I think he wrote a hell of a book. I mean, I've enjoyed every one of his books that he's written, and I just think he's got another winner there. I mean, you know, maybe it's not for everybody, but I mean, I think it has real appeal because it does put a different spin on a story that we think.
Yeah, that's right. And you hope that people will it'll connect because it's not automatic that it will, but it could. And here's a guy, by the way, I think this is right. Was working at the Bethlehem paper and wanted to go to Sports Illustrated and just kept bombing them with story ideas. And the one they eventually bought was about the softball pitcher, Ty Stofflet.
Yeah.
Is that the guy's name?
Yeah.
That's the one that they eventually bought, and that led to him ending up covering the NBA and covering the Dream Team and Michael and Magic and all that.
And Larry. And you know, I remember just reading about how he was around those guys. He just has a real, well, as you can tell from talking to him, he just has an easy way about him. Where, you know, he's going to get to the heart of the matter, but he's not going to, like, beat you over the head, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
And I'm sure it ate at him a little bit that he couldn't get Oscar for this book.
Yeah.
But it probably didn't. Yeah, I think you're right. It probably didn't hurt the book.
I don't think it did.
It made it a little different.
Yeah.
As he said, it made it a little different, but probably didn't hurt it. Yeah.
for some reason, one of the things I remember about Oscar when he played was, you know, this is when obviously not every game was on TV every night of the week. Yeah. It was like they had those Saturday games on ABC back in the day. For some reason, I remember that you could hear him like dropping F bombs, like the time.
He was a talker. Yeah.
Yeah, which kind of spoke to the, you know, the intensity with which he played.
And as he mentioned, as the point forward thing, this was a really big and strong 6'5" guy with point guard skills in the 60s.
Yeah.
When that almost a pioneer in a way. And I remember everybody saying, When Magic came along, well, you know, 6'9" point guards are the wave of the future. Well, how many of them are there now? not really. Well, Oscar was almost like that.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
In you know, 20 years early.
That's a really good point. Yeah, I like that. We wanted to talk a little bit about Caitlin Clark and about how she's shattered like every scoring record known to humankind. On February 15th, she went beyond Kelsey Plum's NCAA women's record of 3,527. On February 28th, she broke Lynette Woodard's record of 3,649. Lynette Woodard had played in the AIAW, which was a precursor to NCAA. And then on March 3rd, she went past Pete Maravich's record of 3,667. Now, how do we regard her? I mean, to me, I'm writing about her, and to that end, I spoke to Tamika Catchings, who was a great WNBA player, and actually a daughter of a former Sixer, Harvey Catchings, today about this, and her take on it was that part of the reason that Caitlin is, you know, a transformative player is because of the era in which we live with NIL and the transfer portal. And I think that's part of it, but I'm not sure I completely agree with that. So what's your take on that?
Well, here's what I think is about the unique to this era is that she is by far the biggest star in college basketball, male or female, because of the dearth of, because of the deterioration of college men's college basketball an entertainment product.
That's
the big thing. And that doesn't take anything away from her.
Not at all.
Because she's doing stuff. I mean, she's shooting from 30 feet.
She's had that Steph Curry thing going.
She does. There's no question about it. And she's got the size to always get it off.
Yeah.
She's got point guard skills. She's a great passer.
That's what I love about her, too. Like Steph, I think.
And she's a big guard in the women's game at 6 foot, I believe she is.
Yeah.
You know, there is some resistance to her. Mm-hmm. There is some resentment of her a little bit among other players, I think, among some people in the media. I don't get it.
No, I don't get it. I think it's just the automatic, there's backlash to everything.
Yeah, that's right. There's backlash to everything. Yeah.
So, but I find her kind of refreshing, and I find it kind of refreshing that, you know, a female player is the most compelling figure in college basketball on either side of the
game. Yeah, and it's not even close.
Yeah, I enjoy watching her because I think it's very Steph Curry, like the shooting, the passing, the whole thing. Which, you know, I love watching him play, so sure, I love watching her play.
and you talk about these shots that we've all been trained to think are very low percentage shots. But she does it every game.
Yep.
She does it every... I mean, she's not like once in a while going shooting 4 for 26 and scoring 13. Mm-hmm. I mean, she gets 30 every game and carries her team. Mm-hmm. I don't think her team would be very good without her.
No, I don't think so.
It'll be really interesting to see how she translates to the next level because there's going to be some pushback.
That's what I talked to Tamika about today, because Tamika was known for her defense when she played. She's been retired for a few years now. She's in the Hall of Fame. And I said, well, if she came along when you were playing, you would look forward to guarding her. And she just kind of laughed, and she didn't really interested. But,
of course she would. Yeah.
Of course she would. Yeah. Of course. And she agreed. She did agree that, you know, she's going to get tested, of course, because, these are very competitive people. These are hyper-competitive people.
Yeah.
And, of course, they're going to say, well, let's see what this woman has to offer.
And, her size is a much bigger advantage at the college level than it's going to be at the next level.
I would agree.
And you can easily, it's easy to think of some of the players in that league that are going to be able to cause some, you know, I shouldn't say cause some problems. We'll see if they cause some problems, but certainly challenge her. It's really going to be interesting to see how she translates. It's a little bit like wondering how Pete Maravich was going to translate 50 years ago.
And if you think about it, he was a good NBA player, but he wasn't like an over-the-top NBA player.
Yeah, and you know, he had a lot of injuries.
He played with bad teams mostly.
If you watch that documentary about Pete Maravich, I had kind of forgotten this, but the one time in his NBA career that he really was in the right situation, it was in New Orleans, and they were really rolling, and it looked like they were going to be one of the best three or four teams in the league. I don't remember exactly what year this was. I'm fuzzy on the details.
Early 70s, somewhere in there.
And he tore up his knee and was never the same.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was about two-thirds of the way through the season, and they had maybe the third or fourth best record in the league. They were really rolling. Mm-hmm. He was playing as good as anybody, tore up his knee. Never really the same.
Was that, did he have Truck Robinson as a team or somebody like that? Or,
well, you'd like to think so.
You'd like to think so.
You'd like to think so. Mindy Rudolph's favorite NBA player of all time. Truck Robinson.
Truck Robinson. Yeah, it is interesting about, because I forgot about that. I know there was some resentment about him when he was with the Hawks.
Yeah.
That didn't work out very well at all. But
I saw that team play. I saw them play the Sixers at Hershey.
Oh.
At Hershey Arena, and I remember going real early because I wanted to watch Pete warm up, you know. And he really, all he really did was a lot of shooting stuff. He kind of like played around the world, you know.
Yeah.
But he didn't miss. He just, one right after another one. They had Lou Hudson and Walt Bellamy.
Yeah.
Pete Maravich, Lou Hudson, Walt Bellamy. And that night, all Walt Bellamy did was he was barely ambulatory and just bitched at the refs. They eventually sat him down.
So. Yeah, he was not a vision of conditioning, as I recall.
Right.
Which year would this have been? Would it have been like this year that he played 50 games for New Orleans, 77, 78 maybe?
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Let's see who's on that New Orleans team. I'm just kind of curious. Jasmine.
That seems like, for some reason, that seems like a good mix. Him and the city of New Orleans.
Yeah, I mean that's probably where Jazz.
Obviously LSU, the LSU ties, but yeah. And the other thing is, he played for his dad in college. I mean, he had as much free reign as anybody's ever had. Not that Caitlin Clark doesn't have free reign, but
yeah,
that's part of the story with him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's certainly true.
No 3-point shot back then, but you know. There were more huge scorers back then with no 3-point shot.
Isn't that odd? I wonder why that is.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm not... I think sometimes when we say... when we talk about a guy from that era and say, well, he didn't have a 3-point shot, like you can automatically add 5 points to his career scoring average. I don't think so. I don't think it works like that.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time finding the year because like all the Jazz seasons I'm finding so far are like sub-500 years.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I'm remembering it wrong. But I remember from that documentary thinking, I don't really remember that. That's interesting. Yeah. Anyway.
But yeah, so we're also in that time of year where state playoffs are rolling along and you're involved in that. And what do you think about our teams? Does anybody have a chance to make a run?
You know, we had 3 district champions out of the 6.
Not any bad.
From Lancaster County. This Linville Hill outfit in Class A. Columbia in Lancaster Mennonite in Double A. Mm-hmm. And Columbia, which got a real good win over Trinity in the district
that
final.
Is a good win.
In
That's AAA. Always a good win.
I think those teams... I think those teams have a chance to play for a little while. I think all 3 of them do. State championship, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
I think Linville Hill and Mennonite both are going to be better next year.
Oh, interesting.
Should be better next year. And then in the bigger schools, then you get into the Philly.
Yeah, so goodbye.
Philly Academy, so probably goodbye. Yeah.
But Mennonite always seems to be around for a while. They always seem to be the last team standing this time.
Yeah, and of course they won it all last year.
Right.
And this is their, fourth straight district title?
I was going to say 3 or 4. I couldn't remember what it was.
And again, they're starting 3 sophomores. I mean, they should be better next. They should certainly be better next year. So, you know, it ended up being a pretty good season. A lot of times that happens when you're looking at it in December and January and you think this sort of feels like a down year. But by the time you get to this point of the year, we usually end up having somebody doing something and we have.
And that's always interesting.
Lancaster Catholic girls, too. They have a chance to win the whole thing, I think.
Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, this is a veteran group. that's kind of, this should be the year for them. And Rhines, who of course covers that sport for us, he thinks they have a great shot.
Yeah, it's interesting because this year is the 50-year anniversary of their 1973-74 championship team, which is something that I'm working on. I've talked to one of their players, and I'm supposed to talk to the best of their players, which is Mimi Sankowski-Griffin. I'm supposed to talk to her tomorrow. So obviously looking forward to that. In fact, I was going to talk to her about Caitlin Clark as well. That was it all comes together, Mike.
I played golf with Mimi Griffin a couple years ago at Saucon Valley when they were getting ready for the women's.
Because she has an event management company.
Yeah,
it's,
she kind of runs golf tournaments. Yeah. Or runs the outside the ropes portion.
Right.
She does that kind of stuff. She's done national network broadcasting. Yep, yeah. She's done a lot of stuff.
Yeah, she's had quite a career. So I'm obviously looking forward to talking with her tomorrow because, you know, that... And yesterday I had lunch with the former McCaskey coach, Pete Horn, and he remembered that team, and he was just talking about how they would do things that nobody else is doing. You know, they would press people. There was one game in the postseason where they forced, like, 47 turnovers, which doesn't even seem possible.
How do you have that many possessions?
I know. Yeah. It doesn't even seem possible.
Yeah. That's the biggest number I've ever heard of.
Yeah, turnovers. Exactly. It jumped off the page. I'd, like, looked at it. Like, one paper had it 47. The other one said 49. You know, it was the Intel New Era days. So.
Oh.
So, and then in the state final, they won the state final. They beat Baldwin 75-32, and they forced 32 turnovers in that game. So
30 turnovers is a lot.
Yes.
I mean, sometimes, a lot of times when you cover a game, it seems like teams are kicking the ball all over the place. Then you're really added up and it's like 18, 19, 20.
Yeah. That's why when it said 47, I'm like, are you kidding me?
That's crazy.
So anyway, I'm working on that, and I kind of look forward to putting those pieces together because, you know, unlike some other retrospectives that I've written, I never saw this team play. I knew of Mimi Sankowski.
Yeah, this is before. I never saw them either. Yeah, this is before me. I know of them, but that's all.
Yeah, exactly. But Pete said he saw them play, and they were really kind of ahead of their time with what they were doing defensively and just really squeezing people, you know?
Well, that would have been like Pete's second year
here,
right? Yes,
exactly. So that was interesting to hear his perspective on it. So
anyway, a couple of weeks away from the state finals up at Hershey. I mean, May 20th or March 20th, whatever that weekend is. So looking forward to it.
Anyway, I think we've landed the plane again, Mike. So
we've landed the plane. Thanks so much to Jack, man.
Yeah, Jack was the best. He really is. I mean, and it's just like it's always refreshing to hear him speak and just his perspective on things. And again, you know, just the way just the care he puts into this, you know, and always has.
What a career.
Yeah,
he's put it together.
Exactly true.
Really has. All right, gang, that's it. He's Gordy. I'm Mike. See ya.
See ya.